Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Poet Robert Pinsky says that while poetry can't dispense information like a newspaper or comfort people as reliably as religion, it can bring us to a level of intimacy that engages our voices, our ears, our hearts. This hour, we'll look at some of the poems that speak to Americans today. First, the oil industry is in the midst of a tense production war between OPEC and other major oil exporters. Prices are way down and could go lower with some unexpected consequences. Earlier, I spoke with Neela Banerjee. She covers the oil industry for the New York Times. I asked her how low oil prices could go and what all this means as we head into winter.
Oil prices are hovering around $18.50, $19. What this means is several things. One is that if they continue to fall and get around the $15 range or so, or even lower, it could be a boost for the American economy. It'll mean that heating oil bills will be lower this winter than last winter. But it'll also mean on the downside that this could be quite a blow for the oil companies and what people call the oil patch, so states like Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Texas.
What have the prices come down from? Where were they?
A year ago, they were probably in the low 30s, and the average this year was about $25. So last week alone, prices fell 20% to, you know, under $20. So it's been a precipitous fall. The first big drop was right after September 11th, and then the second big drop was last week when OPEC basically announced a price war with producers outside the cartel.
It seems ironic that September 11th would create a oil price drop.
Well, what happened was that, you know, people weren't flying anymore, and the global economy went into a tailspin, and oil demand, oil consumption runs parallel to the economy. So the economy is doing well, demand is high, and if demand is high, that means, you know, prices are higher.
Is there such a thing as too low a price for oil?
There is, and it's not just something that, you know, that OPEC countries think because their economies are so reliant on oil. I think, and the problem is that economists say that after a certain point, having a price for a barrel of oil, you know, $10 or $11, it may not be that great shot in the arm that the economy needs, but it's enormously damaging to companies, to regions, and to countries that rely on oil. And if we're concerned about stability in the Middle East, it becomes harder for them to support these enormous welfare states that they've built on oil money if their revenues start drying up.
You were at the OPEC meetings in Vienna recently. Behind the scenes, what were you hearing? How is September 11th affecting what OPEC is doing?
What OPEC is very concerned about is demand, right? That they've seen demand fall off the cliff, and what they would normally do in any situation is cut supplies to keep up with that lower demand. But they didn't do that because a lot of outside producers outside the cartel like Norway, Mexico, and especially Russia, you know, they keep increasing production as OPEC cuts its production. What that means is that OPEC loses market share to non-OPEC producers. So there was a lot of discussion about, you know, do we continue to support price but lose our market share, or do we let prices fall but try to gain back our market share? And they decided to opt for the latter. And they're quite annoyed with Russia, I think.
What are you hearing at these meetings in particular from the Saudis and about the Saudis?
One of the things that you do hear is that on the surface, you know, things are tense because the Saudi press is writing incendiary things about us. We're writing incendiary things about them. So on the surface, things may seem tense, but the longstanding relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia is still strong. I mean, their goals are still the same goals. And then the other thing is that the Saudis, you know, are helping out, but they can only do so much because they're so reliant on the clerics in their country that they can't come out fully and support the United States like, say, Kuwait can.
But have you heard of ways in which they may be supporting the U.S. war effort that have not been so publicly discussed?
I've heard, you know, both from sources in the Persian Gulf and from oil industry consultants who know that area very well and, you know, talk to government contacts there, that the fuel for the bombing raids from American aircraft carriers is coming from Persian Gulf states. And I would assume that's, you know, Saudi Arabia for the most part and Kuwait and others. Now, you know, who will verify that, I don't know, because it's very politically sensitive. Mm-hmm. But I've heard that from sources I find very reliable.
So a kind of a fuel subsidy to the effort.
Well, Yeah, I mean, as one person told me, you know, you're our allies, so if we can't help you now, when can we help you?
With concerns over a possible disruptions of steady oil supply from the Middle East, President Bush ordered the strategic petroleum reserves in the U.S. to be filled. How long would this reserve supply last if we had to tap into it?
The capacity is 700 million barrels, and it's in underground caverns in Louisiana and Texas. Right now, there's about 540 million barrels, 545, and that's good for maybe 52, 53 days. How much 700 will be good for isn't clear because it all depends on our rate of consumption. But really, everybody will tell you, including the Persian Gulf states, that for us to get this elusive energy security, it's really a matter of cutting back our consumption rather than finding more secure sources of oil.
As the U.S. tries to lessen its dependence on Middle East oil, Russia now becomes a bigger oil player. Is Russia seen as a good oil ally for the U.S.?
It's a tricky question in the sense that, I mean, the Saudis and Persian Gulf countries needed us a lot for things like defense, political credibility and legitimacy to help prop up their regimes. I think Russia needs us in some ways less than they do. And I think the thing you have to be careful of with Russia and the Central Asian countries that also have a lot of oil is to not get into the same mire that we're accused of being in the Middle East, and that is propping up regimes that are repressive, that are autocratic, that are corrupt, because we want their oil and gas. And, you know, and if we do that, we run the risk, as we've done in the Middle East, of growing more and more unpopular with the citizens of those countries.
Neela Banerjee, as an industry watcher, what are you watching for in the weeks and months ahead? What are your concerns?
I guess, how low will the price of oil fall, and what will that do to the Middle East countries, to American oil companies? Will it, in fact, help our economy? And the other concern, of course, is that, you know, these countries in the Middle East have taken measures to protect their oil infrastructure, but could there be any kind of retaliation on that oil infrastructure? And finally, whether Congress, especially the Senate, is going to do anything to make this country more fuel efficient and to get us to dampen our rate of consumption, because that really is the key long-term question.
Neela Banerjee covers the oil industry for the New York Times. I spoke to her earlier from New York. Our guest tonight, Robert Pinsky, says poetry is a vocal art meant to be read out loud and never more than now. Everyone seems to have a favorite poem, one where the poet's voice speaks directly to them, comforts them, emboldens them, frames their time and place just right. Poetry is made up of all the nuts and bolts of regular language, words and punctuation, words spoken or on a page. But in the arrangement, we find a special form of communication. So we're asking tonight, in the grind of the current crisis, what are the poems that speak to you? What voices break through and make sense of the world, the heart? And are you finding your own poet's voice in a time of trial? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now in the studio is Robert Pinsky. He's a former United States Poet Laureate and creator of the Favorite Poem Project. Welcome, Robert Pinsky.
Hello, Tom.
It's great to have you. Also with us tonight is our guest analyst, Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor, co-founder of the American Prospect magazine, and professor of economic and social policy at Brandeis University. Hello, Robert Reich.
Hello, Tom.
Robert Pinsky, you're a great collector of poetry and favorite poems. What are you hearing from people since September 11th?
I have received so many poems, dozens of poems, by email and by mail, partly, I think, sometimes that people want me to read on the news hour, but often I'm just on a mailing list. And I understand this partly in terms of enormity, which in English means something terrible as well as something very big. And the buildings were amongst the biggest structures there are. The planes are enormous. The media have enormous scale and have an enormous ability to show us what happened. The number of people affected is enormous. And a poem is on the scale of one person.
And so it helps people reduce events or bring them to a scale that they can deal with them. How does poetry operate in this field of elephants, of giants that you're talking about?
It's a work of art that is great and fundamental, and yet the work of art takes for its medium anybody's breath. It's a vocal medium, but not necessarily performative. So you don't need a great instrumentalist or a great actor. It's in your own voice. And I think that intimacy and penetration explain why people have turned to poetry so much, not only in relation to the enormous scale of the event, but in relation to the relentless power of visual media and electronic media to put us immediately in the presence of the event.
Poetry would seem at first blush to be a frail little vessel before those giant media that you're discussing, but people turn to it. Do you see them turning to a different kind of poetry since September 11th? Is there a different tone and flavor to the poems that people are sharing with you?
There are as many as there are moods and responses of people. Almost every response that anyone has had, there's a poem for it. Often the best poems about the event are written many years before the event. Let me read you a very short poem that someone sent to me that I had sort of known but forgotten. Mm-hmm. A wonderful translation by Mark Strand of the Brazilian poet Carlos Drummond de Andrade.
Read away.
The poem is called Souvenir of the Ancient World. Souvenir of the Ancient World. Clara strolled in the garden with the children. The sky was green over the grass. The water was golden under the bridges. Other elements were blue and rose and orange. A policeman smiled. Bicycles passed. A girl stepped onto the lawn to catch a bird. The whole world, Germany, China, all was quiet around Clara. The children looked at the sky. It was not forbidden. Mouth, nose, eyes were open. There was no danger. What Clara feared were the flu, the heat, the insects. Clara feared missing the 11 o'clock trolley, waiting for letters slow to arrive, not always being able to wear a new dress. But she strolled in the garden in the morning. They had gardens. They had mornings in those days.
The children looked at the sky. It was not forbidden. They had gardens. They had mornings in those days. And this, as you say, from long before September 11.
We've heard so many people say that everything has changed. I've said it. I felt it. Everything is different now. And when he says they had gardens, they had mornings in those days, and the realization that we are or were the ancient world, it's so compact and it's so graceful. And with my same mouth and breath that I use all day to say, is that your car blocking mine? Or, yeah, let's not try that right now. Or, okay, I can be there. That same breath and that same language says something so well, so gracefully.
Ancient world. Robert Pinsky, before you came in, Robert Reich and I were just talking before we went on air about this, the uses of poetry in the ancient world and the uses of poetry today in a time of crisis, in a time of war, and how there was a time when poetry recorded, chronicled, made a record of everything that went on and put it into a grand context. Do you see poetry doing that today, or what is the modern use of poetry compared to that ancient use that we know from epic poems?
It's one of our first means of enhancing our memory and communication. It's a technology, or versus a technology, that goes back to the evolution of the animal. We need to cooperate not only with one another, but we need to get information vertically from our ancestors and to give it to our descendants. And some of this is now done more efficiently by digital media or print media or by scratches we make with a gel pen. But in our psychology and in our body and in the relationship between our body and our mind, this is fundamental. So there may be better forms of chronicle, better forms of transmitting, faxing somebody the instructions to work on a washing machine, but there is no better way of intimately feeling something inside your own breath, inside your own body.
Robert Reich, do you see that ancient, grand form of poetry playing out in the public arena today, or is it now all about the intimate, the personal?
Well, it's interesting. There is this tension or contrast between the public and the private. The whole notion of being a poet laureate, Robert Pinsky, seems to be something that's quite public and even harkens back to echoes of Greek epics. And yet you started this conversation talking about poetry as helping us deal with something that is beyond a scale of comprehension, bringing it down to something that we can understand, almost giving us a personal refuge,
yes,
in a way. Is it public or is it private?
Well, you point out another aspect of language. It's not only that language is inside us and is made out of our breath. Language is also how we conduct our civic life. It's how you tell people they owe you money or that you need a marriage license or any number of things.
Robert Pinsky, hold that thought. We're going to come back to the language and civic life and poetry above all. We're talking about poetry this hour after the crisis with longtime U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky. What poems have brought you comfort, challenged you since September 11th? What poems have given you a perspective you might otherwise have missed? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight we're talking about poetry and how it's playing out in the national consciousness since September 11th. Our guest tonight is Robert Pinsky, longtime U.S. Poet Laureate and a poet himself, most recently of a collection entitled Jersey Rain. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Join Robert Pinsky and Robert Reich, our guest analyst this evening, former U.S. Secretary of Labor. Does poetry have a role for you, a place in your life and mind in crisis? What poems lift you up and give you a better view? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. Robert Pinsky, just before the break, you were talking about the role of poetry in our civic life. One question I would ask is, you, as a poet, listening to everything that goes on around, and particularly our leaders, do you hear the echo of ancient epic poetry in these poems? They seem to reach for the kind of cadence in verse. Do oratory and poetry commingle at any point, or are these really separate streams?
Some people mix eloquence up with poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Poetry is a little bit different than eloquence. It is an art. But I've been happy over the years to suggest quotations of poetry to politicians I like, and they've even used some of this poetry once in a while. And poetry can be used in the interest of eloquence, but it cuts a little deeper than eloquence, in my opinion. There's something more like being touched or hit in a poem. And eloquence is beautiful and great, but doesn't quite have that.
So then how does poetry intersect with our civic life? You know, there are plenty of folks who do turn to poetry and plenty who don't. You've looked a lot at Americans' patterns of interaction with poetry. What portion of our society sits down and reads or listens to or recites poetry on a regular basis?
The only thing I know for sure is more than the stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
The Favorite Poem Project, with a very small advertising budget, we had about a $20 advertising budget. Many thousands of letters mm-hmm. from people in every state in the union and of many different professions, many different social classes, kinds of education, age, who had poems they loved. Sometimes a poem says, like that Drummond de Andrade, it says beautifully what in our political life or our family life we just grope toward. Robert mentioned things classical. Mm. Here's another translation, beautiful translation by David Ferry of an ode by Horace, who was an expert at negotiating public and private. And the poem is personal, addressed to a person, and it also, to me, makes poetry out of the unlikely idea that we have to be prudent, which is what we hear all the time now. We should be cautious, but not too cautious, and we should fly, but fly carefully.
Let's hear it. Sounds great.
To Licinius. You'll do better, Licinius, not to spend your life venturing too far out on dangerous waters, or else, for fear of storms, staying too close in to the dangerous rocky shoreline. That man does best who chooses the middle way, so he doesn't end up living under a roof that's going to ruin, or in some gorgeous mansion everyone envies. The tallest pine shakes most in a windstorm. The loftiest tower falls down with the loudest crash. The lightning bolt heads straight for the mountaintop. Always expect reversals. Be hopeful in trouble. Be worried when things go well. That's how it is for the man whose heart is ready for anything. It's true that Jupiter brings on the hard winters. It's also true that Jupiter takes them away. If things are bad right now, they won't always be. Apollo isn't always drawing his bow. There are times when he takes up his lyre and plays and awakens the music sleeping upon the strings. Be resolute when things are going against you, but shorten sail when the fair wind blows too strong.
Horace, there's comfort from across two millennia. What do you hear there, Robert Pinsky?
Well, people will envy you if you live in a mansion, but you don't want to live in a ruin either. And to be a good business person, you have to go out in dangerous waters, not too far, but if you stay too close, it's also dangerous. And He's the world's most penetrating political moderate, I guess. He says these things with plenty of allusions to the community life, business, how fancy a house you should have. And somehow he manages to make it lyrical. You can picture it as approaching music.
And also, in some respects, literal right now, the tallest tree shakes hardest, the loftiest tower falls down.
Yes.
We all hear that.
Yes.
Robert Pinsky, there are a lot of callers who want to join us. You can join as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking with longtime U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky about poetry after September 11th and how it helps us see and understand the world we're in. Matt is on the line. Welcome, Matt. You're on the line, on the air.
Hi, yes. Thank you for having my call.
Good to have you.
I am actually an English teacher, high school English teacher, and we have had some good luck with God's Grandeur, a poem by Gerard Hopkins. However, I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for us and maybe some poems that young people, early in their high school careers might be able to use to grapple with the events that have transpired in the past few months.
Matt, thanks for your question and your call. We'll all take God's Grandeur, and Horace may speak, but what else do you have, Robert?
God's Grandeur is a wonderful poem, and it does have an image in it of a smoking city, and it sees the Holy Ghost brooding even in that fog, smog, and it has images of shaken foil, industrial crushed oil. Mm-hmm. It sort of humanizes in the course of finding a divine presence in. Technological things, industrial things. Here's a very simple, very powerful poem by Edwin Arlington Robinson, 19th century poet.
Something for youth, perhaps?
I think that this poem is so monumental, so plain, and so full of sorrow, so absolute and minimal, that I can picture reading this one to high school students. Although if they can read Hopkins, you don't have to worry about what they can read anything.
Let them roll.
The house on the hill. They're all gone away. The house is shut and still. There is nothing more to say. Through broken walls and gray, the winds blow bleak and shrill. They are all gone away. Nor is there one today to speak them good or ill. There is nothing more to say. Why is it then we stray around that shrunken sill? They are all gone away, and our poor fancy play for them is wasted skill. There's nothing more to say. There is ruin and decay in the house on the hill. They are all gone away. There is nothing more to say. And if I think of myself when I was in my late teens and early 20s, though I had my garrulous side, I was full of admiration for things that were minimal and knew when to shut up. And this is, to me, a very beautiful elegy expressing that feeling that one can't say anything and should shut up. And like the other poems I've read, it seems to me to say, put very well, things that many, many of us have been thinking and feeling.
Is there a dynamic that shuts people up since September 11th as much as it opens them up? Do you feel the world of poetry and poets clamming up? Is it too soon to respond,
so.
Or is it the opening a vein?
I've heard people say that the line of verse itself goes into silence, that the ragged right is a reminder of silence. And like music, poetry in a way carves shapes out of silence. And I think the mixed feeling that there's nothing more to say and that one desperately needs to say something is part of why all these poems I've been reading to you, by the way, are poems that were sent to me. Those were all suggestions that I got.
Robert Reich, you've lived, like all of us, the personal life and also the very public life in Washington. How have you seen poetry intersect with times of crisis or trial? Have you seen public figures who reach for it, allusions to it, that some suddenly break out of the personal life into a public context, or have you experienced it in a more personal way?
I think it's a very personal thing right now. It hasn't always been personal, but people, whether they're in public life or people simply trying to grapple with the reality of the last couple of months, they are seeking through poetry, but also through music and religion. Ways of uniting the heart and the mind and the voice and the word. In fact, I'd be interested, Robert Pinsky, in how you view poetry in relation to, say, music and religion as ways of uniting the heart and the mind and the word, giving people a little bit of personal solace.
There's a lot of common area in all of these things. I think music is the most sure and penetrating way to feel emotion, whether it's the Barber Adagio for strings or Willie Nelson singing God Bless America or the brass band at Buckingham Palace playing the Star-Spangled Banner right after the 11th. All of these things can just bring tears to your eyes right away. And music, which in a way has no experience, you put it in the context of an experience, it becomes full of content and very, very powerful. Poetry is not that sure, but you don't have to be a great musician to produce a great poem when you say the words of it. So there are different degrees of intimacy in these things. And my experience of religion is that part of religion for people is how deeply communal it is. And it uses poetry, it uses music, it uses all these things. And for people who get deep comfort from religion, it seems to have a lot to do with being with others at the same time. And all these things, if you think of them in an anthropological way, they all have to do with that need we have to feel like we're with others. I say the words of Robinson, and it's a form of possession by the dead. I'm shaping my mouth and my breath in ways that he gave, and there's a strange comfort or reassurance in that.
Robert Pinsky, Robert Reich, hang on. We have a lot of callers who want to come in. Let us invite them. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking with longtime U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky about poetry in the aftermath of September 11th. In all of our personal searches to find meaning and hope and solace right now, what do you think? Can poetry help solve global terrorism? Is that too far a stretch? Sue is on the line. Welcome, Sue. You're on the air.
Hello. Before I read the poem that I chose, I just wanted to thank Robert Pinsky for reading those Winter Sundays on television by Robert Hayden. I found it in a book that I bought for a child's anthology of poetry, and I've since read it to several other people. And it helps to bring them all together, that poem, because they all share something within the poem.
In the favorite poem anthology, I have about five letters reprinted in that anthology about that poem, and they're from people of a terrific variety of races and ages. It's such a beautiful poem.
Yes, it is. The poem that I chose is by Naomi Shihab Nye, and it's called The Art of Disappearing. When they say, "Don't I know you?" say no. When they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem. Greasy sausage balls on a paper plate. Then reply. If they say we should get together, say why. It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees. The monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in the grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appear at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time.
Sue, thanks for that. Is that a poem that you've turned to this fall, Sue?
That's interesting. I discovered that poem several years ago, and I've read it many times to myself and to others. And I guess so, especially that last paragraph.
I think you had great timing, Sue, reading that poem to remind us, after I talked about community, that poetry is not always promiscuously nice or promiscuously gregarious.
Sometimes. Or promiscuously public.
Yeah, sometimes it's about keeping to yourself and disappearing. Right. Thank you.
Sue, thanks very much for your call.
Bye-bye.
James is on the line. James, welcome. You're on the air.
It's a pleasure to speak to you and both of the Roberts tonight. Good. I have to excuse my voice. I'm nursing a small cold here, but
you're loud and clear.
I've been waiting for this show for a while, and I'm very happy to have you finally do it. I've just come from religious training, spiritual training, and I'm looking in international policy training now, and I find that one of the things that some of us who have had the spiritual training find is that those of us who want to believe in beauty right now find a wound in the world that is hard to overcome. And in my experience, religious traditions have used a sort of call and response technique to draw, where the spiritual leader draws the community through their pain and back out into hope. And there are a couple of Wendell Berry poems. I won't read them both, but I do want to direct the listeners' attention to both of them. The first one is called The Want of Peace. And there's a line in that where he says, "We sell the world to buy fire, our way lighted by burning men, and that has bent my mind." And that poem then is followed in the anthology that I have, actually, by a poem titled The Peace of Wild Things, which I tend to think of his call and response.
James, give us a piece of it, but I have to forewarn you, we're coming up on a break.
Very short. "When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free."
James, thank you very much. Thank you very much for that reading. Robert Pinsky, what about this link between fear and beauty? How do they coexist?
Wallace Stevens says that death is the mother of beauty. And I think the implication of that is that we would not need the aesthetic response. We wouldn't have the aesthetic response without a sense of mortality.
But that sounds almost like Osama bin Laden right now.
I think that in every tradition and in spirits good and bad and corrupted and perverted and in beautiful, there is the idea that temporality, Stephen says, does ripe fruit never fall in paradise? That temporality is part of our sense of beauty. And often, the beauty can be ugly. It's never pretty. Now, pretty is something lesser, but beauty can deal with very grotesque things, very horrible things.
Well, if it couldn't, then this fall there wouldn't be much hope of pulling them together.
You tell me when we have time for an ugly poem.
Okay, we'll have time for an ugly poem just after a break. Robert Reich, two thoughts before we go out?
I'd be interested in the cultural roots of poetry. We haven't talked about Arabic poetry, Middle Eastern poetry, the sentiments that we hear and feel there now.
We'll come to that after a quick break. We're talking this hour with former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky about the role and place of poetry in this strange season of pain and fear. We're looking for hope and solace and comfort, and be happy to hear the poems that bring all those to you at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with former poet, U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky about the place and role of poetry in our lives, in our hearts this fall, as we all grapple with a world that's changed, that's timeless, that's hard to get our heads and hearts around. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Robert Pinsky, just before the break, Robert Reich was asking about culture and poetry. You were talking about poetry that's not necessarily pretty. Let's hold the thought about Arabic poetry and culture, the links across for a moment, but give us the poem that you were referring to that's not necessarily beautiful.
I'll try to relate it to that idea. I mean, Persian people, people from almost any Arabic culture, everyone quotes poetry quite effortlessly. Their culture in which poetry is not only at the center, it's part of the accomplishment of a person.
And we've seen on this program Afghan literature, that the oral tradition is very much a part of their lives, much more than ours.
I found today, in the favorite poem anthology, a passage from Hikmet that I think is a good contrast with the American poem I read to you.
Mm-hmm.
Our culture is one that is not monolithic, at least. It's very syncretic. It's made up of many, many, a mishmash of many, many different elements.
Mm-hmm.
So the poetry could not have that kind of currency. We are too different from one another. And there's more of a strain and more of an unruly quality. This is a poem, it's a poem I jokingly called an ugly poem. This is a poem written in response to the September 11th attack by the contemporary poet Frank Bidart. And it's, in a sense, theological. To me, it's full of a kind of a Thomist or Augustinian sense of things. But the poem is a curse. It is called Curse. Curse. May breath for a dead moment cease as jerking your head upward you hear as if in slow motion floor collapse evenly upon floor as 110 floors descend upon you. May what you have made descend upon you. May the listening ears of your victims, their eyes, their breath, enter you and eat like acid the bubble of rectitude that allowed you breath. May their breath, now in eternity, be your breath. Now, as you wished, you cannot for us not be. May this be your single profit. Of your rectitude at last disenthralled, you seek the dead. Each time you enter them, they spit you out. The dead find you are not food. Out of the great secret of morals, the imagination to enter the skin of another, what I have made is a curse.
Curse by Frank Bidart. May what you have made descend upon you. That's the language of a curse.
Well, it's a classic Catholic point of view, as I understand it, too, because it says that the punishment for the sin is full knowledge of the sin. That would cause agony. And what he wishes upon the perpetrators is a complete human understanding of all the people they have harmed, that they really see and understand. He's alluding to Shelley. Shelley in the Defense of Poetry says the secret of morals is to get into the skin of the other. And then in a reflection upon himself at the end, he says, what I've made out of the secret of morals is a curse. And I think it's an extraordinary job of expressing something that we have all felt and had to sort of encapsulate it. It's like a little scar. You don't know what to do with that rage and bewilderment at what feels to us like a deluded, horrible act, but it was committed by people who thought they were doing something good.
But then
he really wrestles with that. He really engages that.
He does. And then there's that skin of the other, the heart of the other, that Robert Reich is asking about. Well, how do you bridge from this curse to,
and he says,
to some link?
Each time you enter them, they spit you out. The dead find you are not food. Here's a poem from the a rather secular poet, but still, here's a passage. I'm relying again on the favorite poem project. Somebody, a 24-year-old student in New York, wrote and said, I identify with this poem about imprisonment, censorship, longing, and belief in oneself more than with any other poem I've read. Poem needs to be heard, please, by the Persian Turkish poet Nazım Hikmet. I'll just read one passage. He enumerates things he never knew he loved. I never knew I loved roads, even the asphalt kind. Vera's behind the wheel were driving from Moscow to the Crimea, Koktebele, formerly Göktebeili in Turkish. The two of us inside a closed box, the world flows past on both sides, distant and mute. I was never so close to anyone in my life. Bandits stopped me on the red road between Bolu and Gerede when I was 18. Apart from my life, I didn't have anything in the wagon they could take. And at 18, our lives are what we value least. I've written this somewhere before. Wading through a dark, muddy street, I'm going to the shadow play, Ramazan night, a paper lantern leading the way. Maybe nothing like this ever happened. Maybe I read it somewhere. An 8-year-old boy going to the shadow play, Ramazan night, in Istanbul, holding his grandfather's hand. His grandfather has on a fez and is wearing the fur coat with a sable collar over his robe, and there's a lantern in the servant's hand, and I can't contain myself for joy.
Robert Reich, you're our wonderful everyman around this table this hour tonight. We're all in a rush. None of us have abundant time for poetry, but when you hear these two poems back to back, Curse and then the Turkish Poet, do you feel suddenly that spell, that way that poetry can crack things open?
Of course. I mean, what we're talking about tonight is expressing what is otherwise ineffable, the inexpressible,
mm-hmm.
and only poetry can do it. It's almost ironic trying to talk about poetry,
yes.
because you can't really talk about poetry. You mm-hmm. have to read it. You have to experience it.
We are delivering the real thing here tonight. We have callers who want to do the same. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Kevin is calling from Cape Cod. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Well, maybe this is kind of a Quaker poem to answer to Curse, perhaps.
We'll take it.
It's called What Loveless True Belief, and I wrote this shortly after the September 11th. What Loveless True Belief. What loveless true believer, by what false voice inspired, did fly this death attack? What freedom lives in rage, by leaders' cry united? What loveless true belief we praise?
Loveless true belief brought down big towers and more than that. Robert Pinsky?
I think, was it Eric?
Kevin.
Kevin, sorry, Kevin. I think that Kevin's idea is very similar to the idea of Bedard, when Bedard uses the expression the bubble of rectitude. And ideally, it reflects back on all of us. We can see the bubble of rectitude in others, but there's a mote in everybody's eye. And in both what you say, Kevin, and in the Bedard poem, I feel the danger of rectitude, that it can become a bubble that insulates you from the most fundamental decencies and truths.
Robert Pinsky, our time grows short. I want to get one more caller in because I think he speaks of your poetry. Todd, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. You speak of condolence and comfort and solace. In fact, poetry also has the ability to describe the horror. And as I was watching the videos of the towers and the people falling out, I could not help but think about Pinsky's own poem, Shirt. And
yes.
Those remarkable descriptions.
Todd, our time is so short. Let me turn that right over to Robert Pinsky. You may not have it in front of you, Robert Pinsky, but do you have a line? And thank you, Todd.
Thank you for alluding to that poem, Todd. I did get an eerie feeling. In fact, for a while, I was reluctant to read my poem Shirt at poetry readings because it seemed too the passage I borrow in that poem is about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, whereas in this awful occasion, people chose to jump off a building, indeed, in New York.
A calamity from long ago. Our time is ticking down, and we won't have time to actually get to it. But a final couple of lines, Robert Pinsky, from...
Here is, very quickly, Marianne Moore's poem about courage.
Just a couple lines, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Pick them out because
in that case, here's the ending of Czesław Miłosz's poem, Incantation. He says that... poetry and philosophia, her ally in the service of the good, are beautiful and very young. As late as yesterday, nature celebrated their birth. The news was brought to the mountains by a unicorn and an echo. Their friendship will be glorious. Their time has no limit. Their enemies have delivered themselves to destruction.
Let your way be lit by that tonight. Robert Pinsky, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
I'm very glad to have been here.
Robert Pinsky is professor of English and creative writing at Boston University, a former U.S. poet laureate, creator of the Favorite Poem Project, and author of 6 books of poetry, including most recently Jersey Rain. Robert Reich, share.
Well, listening to these poems, A Curse, The Souvenir of the Ancient World, some of these other wonderful statements, frightening statements. They make our mere words over the radio seem trite by comparison. what happened on September 11th cannot be described. It almost makes me feel, Robert Pinsky, that what happened can only be described in poetry, really. Mm. That's how it touches us. That's how it lives on.
I think works of art wind up being the most important record of who we are. And if 1,000 years from now people want to know who are the Americans, what happened to them, it will be in our works of art that they'll find that answer.
Listeners, you can read more at our website, WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Thank you both. Each Tuesday evening, a group of women in Oneonta, Alabama, participate in a great American tradition, the quilting bee. As they swap tips and arrange fabrics, the quilters talk about their lives, their families, and the world of Oneonta and beyond. Independent producer Melanie Peoples joined them last Tuesday and listened in as their conversation turned to the war on terrorism.
I'm Elizabeth Herring, and I live in Altoona, Alabama. And I want to be a quilter. My whole cloth quilt has been in 5 shows, and I've got 5 ribbons. 2 first place, 2 second place, and an honorable mention. I was watching the television when it showed the other plane come down there, and I mean turn right into that second tower. And I thought, oh my God, it was like you were watching a movie on television. And I think for a little while, I don't think it registered as real. Because really, I think it's something that was so far-fetched that a lot of people probably saw it coming, but you think stuff like that happens other places that don't happen in the United States of America, because we have people from all countries over here. And then to know that somebody has come over here and they said those people had been here for 5 years with the intent of destroying part of the United States. And then you felt for the people that were left that had lost loved ones. I mean, it's bad that people go to work and end up dead.
Hi, I'm Ruth Davis, and I live in Oneonta, Alabama.
And
I'm glad I live here. Oh, I love Alabama. Of course, I've lived here all my life, but I don't think I'd ever want to live in New York City. But the people live up there and have lived up there all their life. They don't want to live anywhere else. They love it. And you just, you know, you got to just feel for them with all that that's happened to them and the poor mayor. Mm. All I can say is when the bombing happened, those people over there were laughing about it. And I wonder if they're laughing now. It's just awful. But, you know, it's just life, and you just, life goes on, and you just have to, can't stay under the bed. We've got to, life, you just have to pick up and go on and trust in God and hope that for the best.
My name is Joe Aikman. Well, I think I'm more thankful for what I have and the fact that I can quilt in peace, and I'm not afraid that a bomb's going to drop on our quilters' cottage. I certainly regret what has happened, but I think that a little town has much more to be thankful for than the largest cities. And whereas it could happen in a little city, I hope it doesn't, and pray that it doesn't. Well, I just feel very, very fortunate that it's no worse, and I hope the end of it is over for the ones that are doing such devastating things to innocent people. And perhaps they too can take up quilting and quit thinking about poisoning people and killing people. It's much safer to quilt than it is to do some of the things that's been done since 9/11.
There's poetry of a sort from Joy Aikman, Ruth Davis, and Emmylou Nichols at a quilting bee in Oneonta, Alabama. To read poems written in response to September 11th, go to our website at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage, or add your own by clicking on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.